The total state, really, I believe, is a parenthesis in history. It's a failed experiment, a gigantic flop. None of the things it promised to accomplish, it did in fact accomplish. It's incompatible with human nature because human beings don't want to live in cages. And in the 21st century, we're struggling to break out of it. And we're doing it through technological innovations and rampant mass disobedience. I don't think that the total state is long for this world.
All right, folks, Monday morning, and it's time to wake up. I'm sorry, that was a little demanding. You ever watch one of those conspiracy videos, and that's like the only advice they have? Time to wake up, folks. Building 7, wake up. Reptilians everywhere, wake up. Hollywood celebrity insurance murder scheme, wake up. I might like to work something like that into this show. So anyway, today is March 23rd, and we bring our 2015 Liberty Forum discussion series to a close with none other than Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey Tucker is the founder of Liberty.me, which is basically a social network for liberty-minded folks, also a publishing platform where people can write articles, share videos, share ideas. He is a distinguished fellow at the Foundation for Economic Education, where he consults on technology and editorial matters. He's also a research fellow at the Acton Institute, and he is the editor of Laissez-Faire Books. This is his fourth appearance on School Sucks podcast. He has been with us at Liberty Forum the last 3 years, and he also joined us for a review of and a little bit of a debate surrounding The Wolf of Wall Street. He didn't like it. I wanted to try and set him straight. So there's video of that on the website as well. Please go check it out. A relatively unstructured conversation in this show. We veer into a variety of topics. But the day before we were able to sit down, I heard Jeffrey being interviewed, I think, on Free Talk Live. And he started talking a little bit about the progressive era and eugenics. And because of Free Talk Live's format, he just unfortunately didn't get into as much detail as I would have liked to hear him get into. So I thought the next day it would be a topic we could revisit when we sat down in front of a live studio audience. So we did just that. Otherwise, I don't know too much about what Jeffrey Tucker was at Liberty Forum to do. There was only one event scheduled. It was like a brunch kind of thing on the last day. But other than that, I just saw him kind of, you know, Jeffrey Tuckering around ever so gracefully. And I was very grateful that he was able to give us an hour plus of his time on Saturday. Carlos Morales co-hosted the second hour of our Live at Liberty Forum show, so his input here makes for a lively discussion. So that's Liberty Forum, folks. I want to say thanks again to everyone in our audience who supports the show, who made the coverage of this event possible. I want to do more of this in the future. You tell me where to go and how to get there, and you know, maybe I can figure it out and I can bring some of my equipment and do some interviews. I would love that. What else? Oh yeah, there'll probably be a few extras on the website, maybe some video, a secret hotel room show. Whoa. And a few audio clips of Brett as the interviewee instead of the interviewer. I was on Free Talk Live and I was on Flaming Freedom. So go to the website if you want to check that out, if you have time. If not, I understand. Look, I know you're busy. More stuff is coming soon to the podcast feed, including Kevin Geary. He'll be back on the show. We're going to talk about some health and diet topics. And yes, of course, a long overdue podcast masters on the history of the NEA and school politics today. Part one. We cover both. That's going to be a big project. More of that is coming up in the near future. Hey, I didn't forget about Daryl Becker and the science series. That's coming back soon too, so stay tuned for that. And since that series has already generated a bit of controversy, that reminds me that you should get involved in our little online discussions if you're interested. You can follow me on Twitter at School Sucks Show, or if you're serious, you can join our Facebook group. Just search Facebook for School Sucks Project. So that's it. I hope you enjoyed these Liberty Forum shows. Have a great week. After all, today is Monday, a great day to reset. As we've talked about on the show before, it's like a New Year's resolution opportunity that comes 52 times a year instead of just once. And we've all said those things or heard other people say them. Come Monday, I'm going to stop eating all this cheese. Come Monday, I'm going to get organized. Come Monday, I'm going back to the gym. come Monday, I'm really going to stop taking Scientology so seriously. Well, folks, that day is today. It's upon us. Get out there and go get them. All right, here's Jeffrey Tucker live from Liberty Forum. Enjoy. Do you remember our format?
No.
You just sit there and talk about whatever you want.
Okay, that sounds perfect.
Welcome back to hour two of School Sucks live from Liberty Forum. We have a spectacular live audience. This place is packed. Listen to them. Terrific. And I'm being joined by Carlos, who's going to co-host this hour with me.
Hi again.
We're very pleased to welcome back Jeffrey Tucker to the show.
Good to be here.
Your fourth appearance on our show.
I guess it's four, isn't it?
Yeah. 3 years in a row you've sat down with us, and we really appreciate it.
My voice sounds a little bit strange today because I developed a kind of a laryngitis thing going.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I woke up this morning, I was croaking, you know, blah, blah. But it's getting better, and this beer is helping.
Good.
Yeah.
So from years past, what I've learned as far as preparing for a show with you is that I should put a bunch of random topics into a hat.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And pick one.
Right.
So filled up the hat, and I was picking this morning.
Okay.
First was McDonald's. Said we already did it.
Oh, my God.
Second was you want to do McDonald's
No, I would just want to say one thing about McDonald's. They have a new Egg McMuffin that's made out of a steak instead of a sausage.
I don't believe you or McDonald's.
No, it's true. I mean, this thing is... Have you ever had a patty melt? You know, a patty melt? Those are good, right? It's a good sort of steak, you know, sort of ground steak.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, the diner has it.
The diner, right. So just imagine that meat, but inside an Egg McMuffin. It's true, and it's just extraordinary. I had it recently somewhere. I think I can't remember. You know, I think it might have been in the Dominican Republic that I had that. So maybe it hasn't arrived in the U.S. yet, but it was an extraordinary sandwich.
That's possible.
Yeah,
I think McDonald's, I've heard this, that they have, you go to McDonald's and other places, they have things that aren't on the menu here.
Yeah, when I was in Australia, the first thing I had was went to McDonald's, and there was a lamb and beet burger.
Oh, yum.
And it was actually delicious.
Yeah.
It was really good.
You know, they're always rolling out new products and things. That, you know, in New Zealand, there's a thing called, it's not McCafe, but it's actually, it's their equivalent of Starbucks, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And with artisan pastries and all this kind of stuff, run by McDonald's. And it lives on the top floor of McDonald's. And you have to get the old-fashioned McDonald's, you have to go downstairs. That was in Queensland, New Zealand.
When I was in Denmark, the McDonald's was actually kind of the chic place for hipsters to go because it was one of the few places that actually stayed open 24 hours. And so they had like leather seating and everything else, like basically sophisticated McDonald's for people.
But, you know, it's just to me, it's just a beautiful example of the adaptability of private enterprise. You know, the McDonald's keeps reinventing itself and staying a living part of our culture and our lives in a beautiful way through the system of commerce and brilliant entrepreneurship. And I think it's very beautiful and exciting. And people that put it down all the time, you just don't really understand, you know, just how extraordinary it really is that such a place like McDonald's, you know, exists at all.
I agree. I don't go to McDonald's anymore. But there's just not much there for me to.
Oh, is that right?
To eat, but
yeah, I could. I have to admit to you, I could eat there pretty much every day. Yeah. I'm almost always regretting not being there. You know, so.
And that's do you just eat whatever you want when you're there?
Yeah, well, I get a little bit. So I really enjoyed. I don't know if you tried this thing, but they have this new thing called a quarter pounder deluxe.
They have the habanero one.
Well, of course, that's delicious.
Yeah.
Well, it's not habanero. It's a jalapeno. Yeah, jalapeno burger. They don't have a habanero burger.
They have some kind of jalapeno dressing thing.
Yeah. Well, they have a jalapeno burger, and it's very, very good. But it's not a. You said habanero.
Habanero.
You said that.
Yes. I believe it is a habanero thing.
No, I think it's wrong.
Okay.
No.
I'm not going to fight Jeffrey Tucker on the McDonald's.
I'm almost certain it's a jalapeno burger. The quarter pounder is very, you know, which we all know and love it, right? But there's a thing called the quarter pounder deluxe now. And I think it just has, you know, like a larger tomato and maybe some pickles and, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's a more elaborate version of the old-fashioned quarter pounder. And I had that the other day, and I was just amazed. I mean, it's just, I thought it was just extraordinary. So it's hard for me to get beyond, you know, that quarter pounder deluxe at this point to try other menu items. I've never had the McRib. That's something I just won't go there.
Really?
No,
that's where you draw the line.
It's shaped, yeah, it's strange because it's shaped as if it has bones in it, but yeah. It doesn't. I mean, well, that's a little weird.
Do you know how
me.
The market works, by the way, whenever they decide to bring it back in? It's whenever the price of pig actually drops significantly, which happens occasionally.
You know this for sure?
Yes.
But you've already, I'm skeptical of you.
And by the way, it's bacon habanero ranch quarter pounder, so I've not been wrong.
What? You actually looked it up?
Absolutely, I did. Okay. Not going to be called out.
May
I call trivia question when it comes to McDonald's?
Well, since you are now an expert on McDonald's, yeah. Explain to me what happened to the fish McBites. Why were those such a big deal in 2013?
People,
what? No, they were
the idea of McBites when it comes to fish. Something about fish. You kind
of it was Alaskan whitefish. It was extraordinary. I lived all of Lent of 2013 doing nothing but eating fish McBites, and then and
see,
now they're gone.
That's what Catholicism does. That's what it leads to. Everyone.
I don't understand.
Eating nothing but fish McBites for 40 days.
Yeah, 40 days of fish McBites.
So, Jesus spoke of that in
a documentary.
Jesus would have been thrilled to have these in the desert, that's I can promise
sure
you.
40 straight days of fish McBites. So,
but what happened? Why did they not come back in 2014? And here it is, 2015. They're not back yet again. Do you think it's because they weren't successful?
Yeah, that's the only way.
I can't understand it. I promoted them on Facebook.
Yeah, I don't know.
So the second card I pulled after McDonald's was Britney Spears. We already talked about that. So I pulled several other cards.
She's underrated, really.
Performer?
So, as a singer and as a kind of performance artist, yeah, absolutely. I mean, she has her little vocal tricks and that sort of thing, but, you know, she recovered from what was a near disaster in her career, you know, just
she
a few years ago.
Did.
And she did a beautiful job. And now her music is still very exciting. But of course, I love teen girl pop. You know, it's my favorite genre, really. But I think she's just exceptional. And, we don't need to be snobs. I'm really against it. And, you know, what we need to do is look at somebody who's very, very popular, like Britney Spears, and even if we don't particularly like her music, we think we don't, we should ourselves take the intellectual challenge of discovering where is the hidden genius, which I believe from every really successful product in the market, and that goes for music too, there is some hidden genius for why something is spectacularly popular, even if we don't see it initially. And I think Britney Spears poses that kind of challenge for us intellectually.
That's interesting. But you see her as a product, essentially.
Oh, yeah,
like,
sure.
She is every aspect of her image.
Well, her popularity is itself the art, you know. That's part of the trick here, you know. It's not just about the music.
Right.
It's about the persona, you know, which she herself is selling. And the mobs and the hysteria and the fandom and everything becomes itself part of this overall package.
Yeah.
That itself becomes, you know, sort of commodified at its experience. And so we as fans become part of what she is selling, you know, so the division between producer and consumer begins to get very blurry under this kind of art.
Interesting.
I mean, Lady Gaga encapsulated it all in her 2014 album Art Pop, which is a great, you know, kind of epic story from the first song to the last about this phenomenon, about the consumers themselves becoming the producers and vice versa. And the experience of Lady Gaga itself as the commodity that's selling.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Third card I pulled.
Okay.
Eugenics.
Oh, now that's terrifying. I just finished a book. It's a nightmare of a book called Intellectuals in the Masses by John Kerry. You know this book?
Yes, absolutely do.
Have you read it?
Go ahead, though.
I mean, it's terrifying, right? From the very first, you know, we're talking here about essentially a genocidal generation of intellectuals in the progressive era. Racism doesn't quite describe it, I mean, although that's a given. But essentially, it was kind of a eugenics was a ruling class extermination plot that was hatched really at the beginning of this total state at the early part of the century. And they wanted it to go much further than it did, but they thought the public wasn't quite ready for, you know, chloroforming all interiors.
Sure.
So they erected other barriers instead, among which the minimum wage, for example, which was specifically designed to keep people out of the labor market who were inferior, and hopefully in that case they would die out in one generation, according to this, according to the ruling class intellectuals at the time. What's most extraordinary about it is how open they were about it.
367 colleges across the United States by the time of the 1930s were already backing eugenics as a way to stabilize the population growth. Right, and there was 100,000 sterilizations from 1900 to 1974 just in the United States.
It's not possible to understand eugenics without understanding the last quarter century of the 19th century, the last quarter part of that century, because there was such a demographic upheaval. The wrong people were getting ahead as far as the ruling class was concerned. The wrong people were having too many children, and the infant mortality rate was plummeting. Incomes were rising all over the world. It looks very beautiful on paper. You think, how could anybody object to this? But to that generation of intellectuals and political figures, it was actually terrifying. They didn't know what was going to. So this is very intriguing to me because I wouldn't have expected this. You know, I've studied the data. I've looked at all the dramatic transformations from the age of laissez-faire, and wondered why, now that we found the secret to mass prosperity, it wasn't just continued. You know, why didn't we just embrace this free economy that was producing all these miracles?
Because they enjoyed being in control.
Yeah, and it's all about control
of
wealth
about the free
and power.
Market is that there isn't a central controller, and there's no one there to tell you, okay, in 20 years this is exactly what's going to be occurring.
Yeah, and the great celebrators, of course, you know, practically everybody celebrated eugenics and backed it. In fact, you were wildly unorthodox to not be in favor of eugenics. But one of the few people was G.K. Chesterton, actually, and he was ridiculed. All over the continent in England.
It had a positive packaging, though, but we're going to talk about that in a second too.
You want some skull?
Skull.
Yeah.
You need a spitter?
No.
That's fascinating. Not. That was fascinating.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that. Skull is chewing tobacco if you're part of our audio.
It's dip, not chewing.
It's dip. Yeah.
You wouldn't want to think about the carrot stuff.
When you travel internationally, you have to take a lot with you because you're not likely to find it in any other country, as far as I can tell.
Again, a really weird thing. In Denmark, in vending machines, they have
skull. What's with you in Denmark?
I spent some time there.
Okay, you know everything about Denmark and McDonald's menus. Okay, so in Denmark they actually have skull and vending machines.
All over Scandinavia, skull was a big thing, which I found incredibly weird.
Yeah,
although this
is very strange.
This was 2009, so God knows.
Yeah, because you can't find it in Canada. You can't find it in Latin America anywhere. You can't find it in Australia. Or New Zealand. Yeah. Those are the places,
so the places you actually want to go to, unlike Scandinavia, which, who the hell, there's nothing fun to do there. It's very, very pretty, very, very clean, nothing important.
Okay. Well, still, if I go to Scandinavia, I'm going to take my own skull, just in case. I can always sell it on the street.
And the eugenics thing, though, actually plays a part into the Scandinavian topic. Look, I can cross it up. In Denmark right now, they still perform sterilizations on people that they view as being unfit to reproduce. At a young age,
they
moniker there.
So let's.
And they still segregate their schools. They call them multicultural schools.
Yeah.
For the for essentially the foreigners.
Yeah.
And you can see the race differences there between the multicultural schools and the Danish.
But what are the policies that resulted from this eugenics war? This attempt to exterminate non-privileged populations. One of them was the minimum wage, which I've already mentioned. It was specifically designed to exclude a whole range of the population from work. They figure if you're not working, if you're not part of the labor force, then you'll starve eventually, and you won't certainly reproduce. So they'll go away. That was their theory. And Frank Taussig, who was the author of the leading economics textbook between 1907 and something like 1925, his book is called Principles of Economics, has a whole chapter on the minimum wage in which he pushes it as a eugenic solution.
Can you explain that a little bit better? Because I learned a lot about this progressive writing from people like Charlotte Iserby, you know who that is?
Yeah.
John Taylor Gatto.
Yeah.
And I would actually, I mean, now with Internet Archive, you can go and you find these books
right.
that these people actually wrote. And I was like, oh, what a treasure chest of terrible things I'm going to find in here. The way that they explain it in context is interesting to me sometimes. It doesn't sound as as nefarious. So have you read the book? Have you seen how it's rationalized?
Well,
or even just more generalization.
I mean, the idea was to plan the population.
Yeah, essentially.
But which makes sense, actually. It's you know, if you're going to have a planned economy, you certainly have to plan reproduction.
I do have an interesting quote by Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes on the topic of eugenics during around this time. He stated, "It is better for all the world if instead of wanting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes. Three generations of imbeciles is enough."
It's more than enough. What's important about that quotation is not that he said something, you know, outrageous or you know, out of sync with the times. He was expressing the really what was the conventional wisdom of the time, with very few people even objecting to it. You know, certainly not in the U.S. The U.S. was the home of this sort of exterminationist policy. Hitler's whole program was designed specifically on California's program of eugenics.
And was that the sole reason that it was driven underground, was the fallout from World War II?
Oh, sure. No, right. I mean, after World War II, then it became sort of oddly unfashionable to talk about it. But the policies that gave rise to it are still with us. I should mention marriage licenses.
Sure.
Yeah. They were specifically designed for eugenic purposes. That was the whole purpose of them. And we still have them today. And nobody talks about what actually gave rise to him. You know, this is a batshit crazy country, if you want to know the truth about it.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, really. Eugenics, you know, mandatory sterilization, the extermination in one generation. You know, it's of all, you know, basically non-elite whites. It's unbelievable.
Marriage licenses were set up to prevent miscegenation. Like, they would go into the South and state, well, you don't have a license.
Oh, yeah,
now
that's
you
a
have
very minimum.
One. And then they separate whole families.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the things that I look for, you were here, well, I was talking to Kate Baker about how to explain education to people, you know, education versus schooling, in ways that are not off-putting. And, you know, I always think about this time in history, this progressive era.
Sure.
How to describe these people, how to introduce people to these characters, these intellectuals, in a way that doesn't make them sound like James Bond villains. You know what I mean?
They were.
You think so?
Yeah.
Because I think, well, I mean, there is this human part of them, the fear. There was a great amount of fear in that period you talked about before the 20th century, the last quarter of the 19th
century.
Century,
right.
Thaddeus Russell, are you familiar with his work?
Yes.
So he had a great visualization. Imagine you go outside, you know, you lived in America your whole life, your family's lived in America your whole life, you're comfortable, you're upper middle class or upper class. You go out your front door one day and there's a bunch of naked people not speaking English. It's scary. The question is, was it driven more by fear, by this fear, or was it driven more by this ideology like the Fabians had, that they actually were just the zookeepers of the world?
I think the problem was that what happened in the last quarter of the 19th century was historically unprecedented. We had never seen anything like it before. And so you had a whole generation of elites that were just basically panicked. So yeah, fear. But you also had this sort of Darwinian idea that had sort of taken hold, you know, that we had to sort of have a rational system of human evolution. And if we didn't get control of it, then our worlds would be destroyed. And the thing is, the transformation was so fast that it was within people's living memory that the streets of London were filled with, you know, men in top hats and ladies and petticoats and everything was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, just seemed like overnight, you know, you had orphans running around all over the place and decrepit old people, you know, were the sick and, you know, wandering around. So the place went from clean and wonderful and beautiful from an artistic point of view to, you know, just a trashy disaster. And the reason for this was that, you know, these people that they regarded as trash previously would have been dead and now alive, thanks to massive improvements in health and diet and income and all the rest of it. They wanted to shut it down because they thought the world was becoming ugly. Consumer culture was a particular objection for this generation of intellectuals. They didn't like what was happening to the productive machinery of society, that it was turning from serving the elites to serving the masses of people. And in particular, they had a problem with women, you know, this whole generation of intellectuals, because the women had become huge forces in the consumer market for the first time, really, in history. So you had the, you know, the advent of cosmetics, you know, which men always in all times and all places find very weird. So they objected to that. And newspapers, which, you know, women loved, and film, which women were the main consumers of film. And then, of course, the popularization of novels, you know, which was driving out the upper class writers in favor of these pop writers. And so there was a lot of panic. Like, what the hell is happening to our world?
How about this one? Especially in England, around this time that you're talking about, World War One, right?
All I don't understand that entirely, and I don't understand how it fits into that, and I would like to look into that a little bit more. It had to be part of this plot, because everything else was.
No, I mean, with respect to women, like, their growth, as far as influence goes in society, all the men disappear out of British society from, yeah, you know, 1914 to 1918. And I remember reading a book, I'll put it in the show notes, but I don't remember the author. And she was saying that, you know, this was sad in a way that our men had left us. It was sad what they were involved in. But suddenly, you know, we were in charge of society. And there was kind of this...
I can't help but think that was an unplanned result of the war.
Unplanned
in the sense that it was not clear, I think, probably to that generation of intellectuals that you had to have the productive machinery continue to work despite the existence of the war. And of course, women took over that responsibility entirely, and empowering them in ways they had never been empowered before as producers, not just consumers.
And hostile actions towards other men who decided not to fight, which had to do some of the first wave feminists actually were hostile towards those who didn't actually go out and fight. There were a lot of writings from them essentially calling them Nancy boys for what they were doing, for not actually being, yeah, part of the struggle.
By first wave feminists, you mean like the upper class suffragettes, you, yes, know, who gave us prohibition. And so, yeah. You know, who didn't always have the best interest of women in mind, actually, you,
yeah,
know?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even consider that they're kind of creepy. They were also in favor of minimum wages, which were specifically designed to drive women out of the workforce.
Yes,
there was a lot of cultural panic at the time about what was happening to women when they leave their homesteads and move to the city and start earning their own money.
Yes, and because the big can fear buy is their that own Negroes would actually start being able to. Would be willing to take less pay than white people, so that's kind of how.
Yeah, but I mean, it was true for women, and there were, you know, cultural studies that came out, you know, sort of pseudoscience, saying that if women get jobs, they're going to, you know, it's inevitable. What happens? The very first thing they do is they spend all their extra money on silk stockings, and, you know, which is just a very bad sign, mm-hmm, you know, according to this way of thinking. And then they just get loose and wild on the city, and then the culture just collapses. Yeah,
so has some of this research also been part of why I believe you've been steering more against conservatism as of late? Because you can't state that. I mean, some of the reactions that you've had towards...
I don't know what conservatism is. I mean, you know, in a very strange way, progressivism was conservatism.
Yeah,
it was designed to freeze society and stop the progress that was being made because it seemed like a massive upheaval. And so all these measures we saw implemented during the Progressive Era were essentially conservatizing devices. Antitrust laws were designed to keep established corporations in charge and to cartelize the system. The central bank was designed to cartelize the banking system and stop upstart financial companies and banks from encroaching on their privileged territory. The income tax was designed to stop people from making money without permission. Essentially, minimum wages were designed to drive people out of the workforce, to cartelize it only for the privileged few, and so on. Marriage licenses and on and on. Everything was linked to the desire to shut down social evolution and progress. It's very intriguing. But the best book on the topic is, of course, by Gabriel Coco, right? And the title of his book is The Triumph of Conservatism, and it's a history of the Progressive Era. So in the name of these so-called left-wing politics, what they were actually adopting was a right-wing style policies designed to freeze and throw society backwards into time.
Yeah, they seem to also take on a lot of what I would describe as the worst aspects of religion, and like self-denial, sacrifice. Yeah. I think it's interesting to see how people who call themselves progressives of today are just so ignorant of their roots.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is not about individuals. This is about self-denial. This is about sacrifice. All the talk now is we have this rich history of empowering people. And it's totally the opposite, just like it's the opposite of progress.
Well, you know, but almost in a secular way. I mean, it was a kind a transference of a religious ethos, a kind of post-millennialism, secularized, and the state then becomes the god that becomes the central planner over society.
Due to the fact that we started getting new scientific information regarding how the world worked, that mindset still was not invisible. Right, so people still had a dogmatic mindset about how people should be treated. It's just they lost the justification through it's because of God.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, Carlos, can I go back to your comment about you say you've noticed a kind of anti-conservatism that's yes. creeping into my.
That's a strange word.
Yeah.
For
well, So here's the thing that I've come to realize. And I think this is extremely important, and it's a revelation in my own mind, and it has caused a shift in my thinking, because I've come to understand what the 19th century was about. You know, the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the beginning of World War I is considered to be the age of laissez-faire. What was that age characterized by more than anything else? What was the distinctive feature of it? And I would say its distinctive feature was the empowerment of previously marginalized groups. That's it. A circulation of elites and a dramatic upheaval in the demographics of who is in and who is out. Who are the haves and who are the have-nots? And that's really a striking fact. You know, as libertarians, we like to imagine what does freedom look like? We had an experience that was relatively free, probably more so than any time in history of the world.
Give us the time period again.
And between about 1810 and 1915.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. We saw what happened: unprecedented empowerment of the masses of people, essentially, unbelievable. You know, you can look at the demographics and see it just a gigantic hockey stick. Mm-hmm. You know, like for all of human history, almost everybody was poor and dead by the age of 35. Suddenly everything changed. You know, modernity was born. But in what did that consist? Was it anything like conservatism imagined society should work? Absolutely not. It was totally revolutionary. And if you look at the progressive era as a reaction against that, then you begin to see that it was essentially an attempt to shut down, to create a gigantic sort of leviathan intermediating force to prevent us from continuing to bargain with each other, to stop the progress that was being made through laissez-faire, peer-to-peer arrangements. So once you understand that, you get a completely different conception about what freedom is and what the state is. And it adjusts your thinking, and so my thinking has shifted in light of this, light of these historical realities.
So, explain the shift just a little bit better.
Where were you before, essentially?
Yeah. Okay. So, here's the thing. What is the state, and what do we think of it as, and what does it do? And I think there's a conservative tendency to believe that the real problem with the state is that it takes from the haves and gives to the have-nots.
Okay.
You know, they imagine the state is this tool that the sort of teeming masses uses to sort of loot the well-to-do, you know?
They do imagine that.
They do imagine that. The problem is that there seems to be no historical basis for this whatsoever. If anything, it's the reverse. The state is the tool that the ruling class uses to expropriate the masses that would otherwise be empowered under a laissez-faire system. What's important about the story is that it contradicts the way the left renders history and thinks of the state, and it contradicts the way the right thinks of the left and right are like weird mirror images of the same lie.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, the way I've argued with people on the left is like, why do you want to empower the middleman?
Right.
Why do you want to make the conduit wider and have the air suck through it faster?
Right.
You know, because that's it's clear that that's what it is. And I think in a lot of their rhetoric, they recognize that. But they have this fantasy that it's going to be something else someday because there's like these little flashes of Wilson or Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson.
Well, you know, the left is interesting how they variously come to terms with the fact that their policies are actually creating a ruling class oligarchy. You know, they kind of regret that fact, but they don't have any better ideas because their loathing of capitalism is so intense. You know, that they can't embrace the opposite. I mean, this happened at the beginning of the New Deal. I mean, FDR came to power. And announced that he was going to empower the masses of the world with his great policies, and he ended up creating basically a fascist state.
Yep.
You know, consisting of preferred corporations, privileged labor unions, and the government.
It was actual
fascist, and it was a massive ruling class trick. Henry Hazlitt was working for The Nation at the time, and he tried to point this out to his colleagues, and he wrote article after article saying, look, guys, this is exactly the opposite of everything we've ever believed in. You know, what's happening here is a reversal of all of our ideals. How can you go along with this? This is exactly what we've lived to oppose. Join me in opposing this sort of fascist takeover of the United States. But instead of joining him, they fired him and endorsed FDR and rode the wave. And that was the ultimate corruption of left liberalism. And it's never really recovered.
Yeah.
It's been just as corrupt ever since. They came to terms. They made their peace with the fascist state and the ruling class that runs it. And that was the end. The right-wing response to that has been very interesting because right-wingers similarly have this mythical view of the state as being, you know, just an instrument of mass plunder, you know, by which the lower classes, you know, are getting a bunch of freebies from the well-to-do
by striking the fear in our hearts of multiculturalism.
Yeah. A lot of oh, I know. Right.
And everything else.
Yeah.
Which I mean, to be fair, I've fallen for a lot of it,
it's totally understandable. I mean, it takes a lifetime.
Way,
yeah,
but yeah,
it takes a lifetime of reading and studying to finally figure this out, that both the left and the right are lying to us about the true nature of what the state is, and conversely, the true nature of what freedom really is.
And people on our side, or anarcho-capitalists and free market anarchists, they're still propelling these messages of the right.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
they really are. We're stuck in this view. And I've heard this again and again on sort of among right libertarians. They imagine that a free society consists of an oligarchy of rich property holders that are passing wealth from generation to generation, a kind of natural aristocratic elite that emerges as a kind of ruling force of society. This is utter bullshit.
But that's what you would have been more sympathetic to in the past, just from our past conversations, right?
Well, I have no problem with natural aristocracy,
okay,
and that's great. But the facts on the ground speak to the completely different reality. That it's the marginalized groups in society that are the ones that win the most from laissez-faire because they're given a chance, and they can topple the elites. And that's what we saw happening throughout the 19th century. And that was precisely why the Leviathan state was created in the 20th century, 100 years ago. It was a total state. How World War I fits into that, I don't entirely understand. I would like to understand that a little bit more.
I only really applied that to the empowerment of women, like growth of women in society, the economic empowerment of women.
But again, I think it was inadvertent because there was a mass panic among the intellectual class at the time about what the changing status of women.
Sure.
Since women were the main beneficiaries of the age of laissez-faire, you know, from about 1850 all the way up to 1910, we saw huge demographic shifts in the status of women. They became workers. They became very powerful consumers, giving rise to all sorts of new industries, adopting new status, leaving the old subjugation, and becoming actually full right members of the human community for the first time in the history of the world. And you talk about something to make the patriarchy panic. That would do that.
Yeah. And the reason why I brought up World War I is there was this 4-year period where the men weren't around to keep them down.
I mean, there's no question that the purpose of World War One was exactly as Jack Reed said, profits.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, there are other benefits.
It was a corporate racket, yeah, right? Yeah. But there were other things at work too. And this is why I want to read more about it. From everything I read about the panic about the empowerment of women during this period, I can easily imagine people just hatching a war saying, you know, we need a big manly thing going on right now. What do men do best? We kill people. Let's have one of those and make it on a global basis. Let's just kill a ton of people. Yeah. Just to assert how fabulous we are as men. I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there. This might have been part of the motivation.
Well, as a result of the largest economic boom in history, we ended up with one of the most intimidating, destructive war powers in history because they were able to loot and plunder from that. I mean, just within about a generation, they were able to destroy all the accumulated wealth from 1815 to 1915 in World War One.
You know, I think as we're talking about this, and I think it's important for listeners to understand something very important. Libertarians talk very broadly about the state, you know?
Yeah.
And that's fine. The state has always and everywhere been a problem. But the 20th century state was different from anything that had ever preceded it.
Yep.
Because it was a total state, right?
All the lessons of the past into action.
Yeah, and I on Sunday I'm going to be spelling this out. There are three great stages of the development of the state. There's the personal state that basically went from the Middle Ages up from the ancient world all the way to the Middle Ages, where the state was some total of the state was embodied in basically one person, the king. You kill the king, you kill the state, and it's dead, right? That's it. That's the personal state. Then you had the birth of the nation state that comes about 100 years before we see the rise of capitalism. And that was, the nation state is characterized by a sort of immortal quality that there's now a kind of permanent ruling class of bureaucrats that, you know, the king dies, the bureaucrats live. That becomes the real source of power of the nation state. It's a different thing from the personal state. It doesn't go away, essentially. You can't sort of get rid of it. It becomes a permanent cancer on society.
It's the birth of the government, essentially. You know, the actual
buildings.
Yeah,
it's what we actually call it. Yeah, and you know, we still have the nation state with us today. I mean, we elect these politicians. But I don't know. I did some calculations the other day for an article. You know, we elect something like 0.02% of all the people who actually rule us. You know, it's laughable.
There's more people in the shadows.
The elected state is just a little veneer that to entertain us, essentially. But the shadow state or the deep state is the real state, right? But I do think that you have to even make a further distinction between the nation state and what happened in the 20th century, which is the total state. This is a state that does not acknowledge any limits on its power whatsoever. And I'm not talking about just Russia or Germany and all that stuff. I mean, every state in the world, in the developed world in the 20th century, became total. So that there's nothing outside of its purview. There is no practical limit on what it can and cannot do.
Yeah.
And that was really born 100 years ago. But you know what's important, I think, to understand about this? The total state really, I believe, is a parenthesis in history. It's a failed experiment, a gigantic flop. None of the things it promised to accomplish, it did in fact accomplish. It's incompatible with human nature because human beings don't want to live in cages. And in the 21st century, we're struggling to break out of it. And we're doing it through technological innovations and rampant mass disobedience. I don't think that the total state is long for this world. And if we could live long enough to see it, there will come a generation at some point in the future that will look back at the 20th century and say, what a ghastly, horrible thing that they did. That was the stupidest thing imaginable. They had something good going, this thing called freedom, these things called human rights, and it was going pretty well for them. And they shut it down. And they replaced it with this total state. Then it ended in mass bombings and nuclear weapons and holocausts and gulags and mass poverty and human suffering. What the hell was with those people? But fortunately, the 21st century came along, and a lot of creative entrepreneurs figured out a way around it.
Yeah, so that actually leads to an interesting question as far as the future is concerned. Do you see it as a slow stepping back from, like a stepping down from total
state? I don't
think
it's happening.
Or do you think it's total
happening
collapse?
It's happening very, very quickly by any historical standard, you know?
Okay.
The first smartphone was invented, you know, like 6 years ago. I mean, it's just extraordinary to think of. Well, I guess it became the first iPhone entered in the mass consumer market in only 2008. You know, the blockchain was invented. The white paper came out that same year. Mm-hmm. And I forget now when the Silk Road came about. I guess 2011, I suppose. And the blockchain is capable of becoming a new form of government. And you look at the rise of this layer that sits on top of the physical world of the digital society, and the pace at which it's advancing. It's absolutely astounding. And you know, I too am worried about NSA spying and all the rest of it. But it's a joke compared to the pace at which things are moving.
Thank you. You preempted me there. You rained on your own parade and didn't let me rain on.
I know the libertarian mind.
Yeah.
Libertarians, you know. Libertarians are funny. We're woefully naive about the state. We think it has all power in a very strange way. In fact, it should be the opposite. Libertarians of all people should be convinced of how little power, in the end, the state has to control history.
The only reason I think that when you talk about these technological developments is, I agree with everything you're saying, but it's like, yeah, but they have them first. They're using them before we've even heard they exist. And I just did a 6-hour roundtable a couple weeks ago about the NSA based on Bill Binney's revelations. Are you familiar?
No.
He came before Snowden.
Okay.
He was a very high up technical guy. He was there for the inception of a lot of these programs that Snowden revealed. And it was terrifying.
It's scary. It's all scary. And there are some very real victims of this. I mean, I have to tell you, last night I had an extraordinarily, how can I describe this? It was a moving moment in my life. I had a conversation with Ross Ulbricht on the phone. Talked to him, you know, from his cage.
Yeah.
And he's a human being.
Yes, he is.
With a delightful tenor voice and a ebullient manner, despite everything that's happened to him. So it made me very sad to have that discussion with him. Because he's a real innovator and a creator and a person whose innovation is capable of saving so many lives and changing the world for the better. And in fact, his innovation has already done that and continues to do that. There's no stopping Dartnet narcotics markets. They're bigger than they've ever have been. But there's a lot of victims along the way, a lot of martyrs, really. But the progress is happening very, very quickly. And we're living in revolutionary times. We truly are. We need to always remember this. 40 years ago, you know, the kind of communications technologies that we have now, the ways in which we can sort of harness them to improve our lives and make ourselves freer, would have been inconceivable.
And they're not going to get tangled up in bureaucracy like they do on the other side, on the dark side. You know,
so you know what matters here, and I think we really need to understand what it means. Yeah,
Carlos has got to go because he's got a speech, but you and I can talk for another 10 minutes.
Carlos, you can't go. No, okay. Well, thank you for your insights about McDonald's and other things. So,
good luck with your talk, Carlos. I'll try to get in there as soon as I can. But go on.
Yeah, I wanted to say something about the distributed network. And again, I have to apologize for my voice. I know it's not beautiful to listen to. But the distributed network is a unique thing in history.
Yeah.
Because it's the first real great technological investment that the government ultimately cannot take down. Every other technology we've had in the history of the world has been basically physical and then stolen by the state and used to oppress us. The distributed network can live simultaneously in trillions of places. There's just simply no way a government can control it. For two reasons. One, it lives outside of geography, and also it lives outside the physical world. The state only has those two critical features about it. It uses coercion against physical life,
right,
and it lives within a geographic jurisdiction. So if you can come up with a technology that evades both of those things, then you've got the perfect weapon to use against despots.
Absolutely. You know, and when we were going through all of these scary Bill Binney revelations, it was my first thought. Like, okay, well, what would the answers be? How could the problem be solved? And I immediately started thinking, blockchain, how could it, you know, get around some of these things? And what's already possible that I don't even know about? Because there's probably quite a bit.
Well, you know that I officiated at the first blockchain wedding. There's a couple. They married each other, of course, but I was there sort of officiating, as they say. Mm-hmm. But instead of applying for a marriage license, they just posted their vows and their commitments to each other on the blockchain.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful way to kind of evade this eugenic tool of marriage licenses. I really do look forward to a very beautiful digital future for romance, really. It begins with talking, as it always does, and then texting, lovely, and then eventually you become Facebook official, and it ends in a beautiful blockchain wedding. So that's my vision of romance in the future.
First of all, just a side note, you are officiating my girlfriend's sister's wedding in April in Auburn, which I'm really excited
about. Yeah, I was so honored to be asked.
Cool.
Yeah, I got emotional, you know, at the first blockchain wedding because I thought, well, it's an interesting experiment in the use of distributed technology and open source cryptography, yeah. You know. But it didn't really become real for me until I saw the bride starting to walk down the aisle. And sure enough, I'm a little bit of a crier. I started crying. And I gave a very long homily about exchanges and as the basis for love. There's a reason we exchange rings instead of just put them on our own finger. We give them to each other. And about digital technology is the thing that's going to revive an old-fashioned sense of true romance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we warm up, we work out, and then we cool down. And we're in that stage now. So
okay.
Just a couple loose, light questions.
Okay. Going back to this whole thing about my understanding of freedom in the state.
Yeah.
Did anything I say surprise you?
No.
Okay.
No.
So I think it's a really interesting thing. I think libertarians need to get really busy reconceptualizing our sense of what freedom is and for whom it is constructed. You know, who are the main beneficiaries of liberty in our world? It is not the rich. It is not the ruling class. It's everybody else.
Yeah.
The main purpose of the state. And once you understand this point, you understand the headlines as you've never understood them before. If you see the state as a tool that the ruling class uses to exploit the rest of the population, everything else makes sense.
Very well said.
Yeah.
So, cool down questions.
Yeah.
Number one, I swear 40 minutes ago I saw you put this in your mouth. Like a true gentleman, I never saw you spit once.
No, well, I don't take enough to bother
Oh,
spitting.
You only take a little at a time?
Just a tiny little bit.
Now, do you know how to pack it?
I don't. And you know what? It doesn't need to be packed. I don't know.
I would like one of these once in a while, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's a fun
You're welcome to it.
I'd put in a big one.
You're one of those. I know. This lasts me a full week.
Oh, that's great. That's good.
Yeah.
So if you want to pack it, if you want, you know, if you're ever in like a circle of people who are dipping and you want some cred, you have the index finger loose like this.
I've seen people do that.
Right. And you just...
I'm not an authentic... Oh, look at you. Oh, see, you know what you're doing. Yeah, I don't know how to do that.
This is very therapeutic.
Yeah. No, that's amazing. But I don't know why you do it. I mean, apart from this whole ritual,
look now,
you know, which is lovely.
I messed it up. Hold on, one more. But when you're done, it has put it all together.
Oh, sure enough.
Nice and tight for you.
Yeah, but I don't know why that even is necessary.
It isn't
at all.
I think it was just for people
but
who
look
are
at
serious
this, look
about
at this warning. It's like, please
fingers.
Don't use this. It's a catastrophe. It's going to destroy your life. You know, I have some sense this is better for you than cigarettes, don't you think?
Well, I think it has different risks
no,
than cigarettes.
No, it's surely better for you than cigarettes.
Well, I think
surely.
It's bad for your mouth. It's bad for your teeth.
Almost everything's bad for you. Whatever. I've heard that even McDonald's is bad for you.
You know,
Do you think that's right?
Yes.
I don't think. Do you think that's right? Okay.
Yeah. I think that's next year, maybe debate format on
okay,
McDonald's,
right.
And I'll do my homework. Two more.
So I have some beautiful hamburger cufflinks. I'm sorry, I'm not wearing them right now. Right now I'm wearing Dogecoin cufflinks.
Those are beautiful.
Yeah, thank you.
We're almost out of time.
Okay.
Facebook official, you mentioned that. Is
yeah.
that important? Should people do that? Or is it okay if people don't want to be public that way?
Well, I don't know what's going to happen in the future because, you know, young people are no longer using Facebook, you know, like they once did.
Right.
One of my favorite apps, I don't know, have you used it? It's called Yik Yak. Have
no,
you seen the...
No.
That is a fascinating technology. You know about Yik Yak, yeah. So, what it does is you could just... It shows conversations taking place within a square two-mile radius of wherever you happen to be sitting.
Right.
And they're all completely anonymous. It gives you a snapshot of the culture around you. just instantly. And you post on it, and people can upvote your comments and upvote your posts, and it's completely anonymous. It was invented by two kids in Atlanta, actually, who were both just college dropouts. And Yik Yak is really taking off. It's a wonderful, wonderful technology. I like it very much. I mean, depending on where you are, it can be lurid, you know, so prepare yourself.
Yeah, oh, sure.
But if you're in a community where lurid things are not happening, it's perfectly wonderful. But a college town like where I live, wow, you're going to see some things that you're not going to believe.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, yeah. I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, Yik Yak. That's what a lot of young people are doing now. I don't think there's anybody on Yik Yak over the age of 23, say. So, you know, you have to be careful. But be careful, my friend. But so I don't know. I don't know what happens. I don't know what happens to Facebook. Facebook official stuff in the future, because young people just aren't using it. It's just not, it's not cool anymore. What's the next replacement for Facebook? You know, I don't really know.
Yeah.
I mean, for liberty-minded people, I created liberty.me, which is doing very, very well. It's been open a year.
That's right. Yeah.
And we have, you know, many thousands of members. I'm thrilled about what it's done as a technology.
That's right. Last time we talked, you hadn't even launched yet.
No, so. That's right. Yeah. So. It was just a dream, you know, to create a publishing platform and social network for liberty-minded people to be able to communicate with each other and crowdsource ideas for making the world a freer place.
Excellent.
You know, I came up with the idea because I have lost... long ago lost all faith in politics. I don't think that's the way we're going to change the world, through politics. Reform doesn't come from the top down.
Right.
It comes by people at the grassroots, acting and behaving as if they're free.
Yeah.
States eventually come around to either be obsolete or acquiesce to the new reality in their midst.
Yeah.
So I wanted to create Liberty.me as a kind of an alternative to political organizing. But also as an alternative to the endless sort of seminars that libertarians do. I mean, we're forever, holding seminars as if education alone is enough. I think education is important, but it's not as important as action, actually.
Absolutely. Education
has to be followed by some kind of action plan. Otherwise, you just sit and, you know, you believe in liberty, but what do you actually do about it?
It's like the old cliche, wake up. Yeah.
Yeah.
And... then
and what?
Yeah,
what?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
So education, yes, is very important, but that's actually a good point, because we've tried to do that on my show. Like, how is it actionable?
Right. And you focus on schooling, which is, I think, a great thing. You know, anybody who kind of goes along with the public school system and expects that to be the answer to all things is completely lying to themselves, you know?
Yeah.
I have an article coming out you'll actually like. It's coming out on fee.org, I think, next week. But I talk about the episodic upheavals that take place in kids' lives in the course of their public schooling.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting and strange thing that the government has created. So that you have to stay with your class, you know, from second grade all the way up to 12th grade.
Yeah.
And you've invested yourself very heavily in a kind of a social network. And you've developed friendship networks that are very rich. And you have a certain social status and social standing among these groups. And everything seems to be going well for you. But then, of course, you know, everybody graduates and the whole thing is just blown up. You know,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Like a freaking explosion, and you write in people's yearbooks, you know, please never change. You know, it's kind of a pathetic thing to say, really, because what they mean is that, you know, surely there's something we can hold on to from this massive investment of ourselves that we've made,
yeah,
in our lives. But no, the government takes it away from us. So then, what do? We start all over again. We go to college. And we spend the next 4 years developing very thick, rich social networks and deep friendships
These
and loving relationships.
Friends.
And, yeah. You know, and we develop a certain sense of ourselves and a sense of others. And we have big life experience. And then comes graduation day and it's all exploded again. Hiroshima, you know, and the diaspora begins all over again. Then you got into the workforce and you're like, what the hell am I supposed to do now? You have no contacts. You have no hooks into the commercial world. You have no contacts. Everybody you know and love is in exactly the same boat you are. They're not in a position to help you. And young people are thrown out at sea. This is a very unnatural way that life should be organized. I mean, it's crazy. We should have systems whereby we invest ourselves in social structures that continue to benefit us over the course of our lives, especially as we're going into a career.
And but we're breaking free, too. That's something that, as you were talking there, made me think of. We're breaking free of proximity relationships. Like, if you think about it, relationships were always just based on, like, I was born here, so I'll just know the people who live 2 miles around, until it got to the point where, I go to school here, so I'll just be friends with the people who are here, whether they're, you know.
Right, and it's all really artificial, too.
Exactly.
Because, you know, we're assigned this slice of friends. You can be friends with these people you're moving in your class with, you know, but you don't have friends that are older, that are commercially successful in a variety of fields, or people who are younger. No, you're kind of weirdly isolated. This is what our schooling system has done to us.
Schooling is, made possible by force, but those kinds of relationships generally, not force of guns, but force of circumstances.
Yeah, it's like very strong nudges, and this is the world we've created for ourselves, and it's extremely cruel, and it has nothing to do with reality. And if you ever know any kids who are homeschooled and they're 16, 17, 18 years old or something like that, what you find is that they're a little bit unusual. They're mature in ways that are unexpected, typically. And one of the reasons they're mature is that they have friends who are older, they have friends who are younger, they have friends who are adults, and they know many, many adults, not just their teachers, not just their parents, but many actual real life people. And so they have models to aspire to, and they have richer, deeper, more fabulous personalities, and they're better prepared for life itself. Yeah, well so said. It's really interesting. It's a fascinating thing to think of.
So I was hoping we'd have time for a sweater vest question. We don't.
Maybe
I'll talk to you about
That's a little peculiar, isn't it?
I've always said to people, you know what I want to do? I want to wear a sport coat with a sweater vest, maybe a tie, maybe no tie, maybe slacks, maybe jeans. I'm not afraid to wear jeans.
I experiment a lot. Like last night.
But people would say, "Don't wear a sweater vest. You can't do that."
I must tell you that last night I put on a high collar. And it did not work with the sweater vest, so I took the sweater vest off. But now that I have on, it's still a high collar, but it's folded over, right?
Yeah.
And I think the vest works with it.
No, it works. I think it works like a gray vest, perfect color. That's navy blue, right?
It's a navy blue pinstripe.
Yeah,
right,
it looks
double-breasted. Right.
And that's what I picture.
It all works.
For myself. Yeah. And everyone always said, no, sweater vest or those... sweater vest or even a V-neck sweater.
No, don't listen to you have to dress in the thing that makes you most comfortable and confident.
I'm done
yourself.
Listening to those people.
Yeah, no, right. Yeah, just listen to me instead.
All right, Jeffrey Tucker, you are one of our favorite guests on
Thank
School
you
Sucks.
For having
this
me.
Has been
and thanks for indulging me on all these big thoughts.
It's our pleasure. Thank you so much.
All the best to you.
All right, bye.
Thank you.